At the core of Pitalkari's theory is the realization that if something happens on your watch, with your permission, it is your fault. Whether you intended it to happen or not, it is time to choose sides and take action. For he who gets hurt will be he who has stalled.
Like a lot of stories about social movements, the one I'm going to tell you about starts with a protest. On May 6, 1983, years of boycotts and tensions between students and faculty at Harvard Law School bubbled over. Hundreds of students descended on the office of the dean that day. George Bisharat was one of them.
At that point, we were rolling in terms of our movement, and we had a lot of momentum. We had a lot of popularity. I mean, the students were, they'd never seen anything like it. It was exciting. It was thrilling. And it was empowering. That was really what it was. You know, the idea of students occupying the dean's office, it was brave. It was courageous.
The occupation of the dean's office made mainstream news. A piece in the New York Times said the size of the crowd seemed to surprise even the protesters themselves. The paper reported conservative students and white students standing in solidarity with minority student protesters. All told, 500 people showed up that day, a third of the law school's entire student body.
I remember seeing James Vorenberg, who was dean at the time, coming in, and we were all sitting all over his floor throughout his office suite. We had the place packed, right? And he took off his shoes and kind of tiptoed between us to get into his office. He didn't want to hurt anybody with his hard leather-soled shoes, you know. He was trying to be decent about it.
In the late 70s and early 80s, students at Harvard Law School were pushing to desegregate the school's faculty. They were also asking for policies to create better conditions for women and racialized students. But for reasons you'll hear soon, the students were not satisfied with the faculty's response to their demands.
We were at odds over some very fundamental things.
People at the protest were there for a variety of reasons. Some went to push back against a new policy that would give students a grade for how often they spoke in class. Those protesters held signs saying, "Only dogs bark on command." Other students were there to protest the end of anonymous grading. They were concerned that women and students of color might be subject to discrimination if their names were on the work they handed into faculty. That's how little trust there was. George was there with a group of students called the Third World Coalition. They were raising awareness for an unresolved issue from months earlier.
We wanted Derrick Bell back or somebody like Derrick Bell to join the full-time Harvard faculty.
Before I tell you about Derrick Bell and what students did when, spoiler alert, he did not come back to campus that year, I think it's worth noting that George could never have known that Derrick Bell's departure, the protests, and everything that followed would be the catalyst for one of the most talked about theories in America today, critical race theory. Now, I know that George and the other former students you'll hear in this episode could never have predicted what comes next because I was there too, right next to all of them, boycotting and dreaming of how things might be different for us. And I'm still processing how today's backlash against the work that we started as students has changed my life.
It troubles me deeply that my friend, my compatriot, my sister, Kim, Professor Kim Crenshaw, as she's known to most of you, she's Kim to me, is a target as a consequence of this stuff.
I am Kimberly Crenshaw. I'm one of the first critical race theorists, a graduate of Harvard Law, and co-founder of the African American Policy Forum. Now, depending on where you get your news, you may have heard very different things about me and the work that I and my colleagues have done over the years.
Thank you very much. Critical race theory, it's a concept that has become widely controversial across the nation after the death of George Floyd in 2020 and the push to make sure certain history is taught in schools.
Kimberly Crenshaw. American civil rights advocate and a leading scholar of critical race theory. Everybody know what that is?
It's not going to be allowed in Florida classrooms. Spending tax dollars to teach kids that America is a rotten place is absolutely unacceptable.
Joining me now is Kimberly Crenshaw. So it is your fault, madam. I tripped over the curb this morning and I went, critical race theory? Damn you! It does everything bad. I mean, and the cicadas, y'all really need to stop with the cicadas critical race theory. That was not nice.
We can throw everything in the bag. Everything in the bag.
Critical race theory, or CRT, is something I've used in my work since the 80s. I'm a legal scholar, which means I analyze how laws help and harm people who are subject to them. Much of my work disrupts the idea that laws are neutral. And that can be hard for some people to understand because we're raised to think that justice is blind, that the law is just the law with no fundamentally good or bad characteristics. But laws aren't benign or inanimate. They're alive, and they reflect the values of the people who write them and enforce them. In my work, I've argued that laws often uphold the country's race and gender hierarchies instead of being used to level the playing field and break those barriers down for folks. CRT is a tool I use to determine whether a law or a policy is more likely to help or harm people of color. But of course, people of color aren't a homogenous group. So I might use CRT to zoom in on one group in particular: Black folks, East Asian folks, Pacific Islanders, South Asians. Because each distinct group is likely to have an equally distinct experience with laws and policies. Some laws were even specifically designed to attack those groups, like the obvious examples of slavery, the Chinese Exclusion Act, or the legal internment of Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor. Those laws are easy enough to identify as discriminatory, but the thing that critical race theorists want to understand are a little less obvious at first glance. We ask questions like, why is racial inequality so prevalent, even though racial discrimination is illegal? With Jim Crow laws and landmark court cases like Brown versus Board so far behind us, why do African Americans still die so often from police violence or have lower than average education outcomes? And how might the law in particular be contributing to the subordinate status that so many communities of color still endure? If you've ever asked a question like this, guess what? You're a critical race theorist too. So if someone asks you what CRT is, you can say that it's a way of identifying how social systems and institutions like law, education, healthcare, housing produce and perpetuate racial disparities. And it's a flexible framework. It grows with us because our culture changes every day, which means race dynamics do too. Critical race theorists keep up with those shifts by continuing to interrogate how systems affect people. And we advocate to close equity gaps when we find them. I've dedicated my life to legal scholarship, and I've built a beautiful community doing it. So you can imagine my shock when I first heard that my life's work, something I care for so deeply, was being labeled as divisive and banned.
Getting critical race theory out of our schools is not just a matter of values, it's also a matter of national survival.
I heard about the ban at the same time as everybody else. It started with Trump's 2020 executive order, which he unironically titled Combating Race and Sex Stereotyping. Essentially, the executive order said that diversity, equity, and inclusion training was reverse racism, attacking white people. It also said most DEI efforts spread the notion that, quote, America is an irredeemably racist and sexist country, unquote. The executive order inspired copycat legislation all over the country, even after President Biden reversed the order when he took office. In the 3 years since, cities and states have used that same logic to ban critical race theory, anti-racism, the 1619 Project, and so many other important frameworks for dealing with racism in America's past and present. That's how the anti-CRT attack mounted in the education system.
Just because I do not want critical race theory taught to my children in school does not mean that I'm a racist, damn it.
And then that unforgettable bat signal calling white nationalists across the country to step forward came from the commander-in-chief himself.
Are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups and to say that they need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha and as we've seen in Portland?
Sure,
are you
I'm
prepared
willing to
specifically
do that, but
do it?
I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Proud
boys, stand back and stand by.
With those words, stand back and stand by, no one with sense could deny that this attack against DEI and progressive policy and Black thinkers was the start of a horrifying backlash. Ultra-conservative factions had been waiting for their moment to strike ever since the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020. And I rang the alarm because I knew, as a student of history, that anytime progress is made for marginalized people in America, especially Black folks, our opponents strike back twice as hard. We've seen the same thing for centuries, from the flame-licked buildings of Black Wall Street to the racists wielding tiki torches in Charlottesville, Virginia. By the time Fox News started coming for critical race theorists, it was also clear that politicians were angling to make their careers on this anti-CRT wave. Fox mentioned CRT nearly 2,000 times over a two-month period in the summer of 2021. Right-wing media turned CRT into a buzzword, and liberal outlets didn't do much to help Americans separate CRT fact from fiction. Disinformation spread, and conservative politicians latched onto the fear that this bad information put in the hearts of the public. They knew the anti-CRT fervor made this the perfect wedge issue. My inbox and mentions were flooded with questions. And even though it's all we can talk about these days, it's very clear to me that people don't know what CRT really is. In this series, I'm going to answer that question once and for all. We'll talk about all the confusion, the half-truths, and the straight-up disinformation about CRT that's been dominating headlines. We'll also map out the playbook that allows politicians to forge their ignorance into law with anti-CRT legislation, Stop Woke, Don't Say Gay bills, and other tools of hatred that are turning back the clock on progress we've made for human rights in this country. Y'all, it's also my mission in this life to make sure you know your history. So I'm going to take you through the times we've seen similar battles to this war against CRT in America's past. Nothing playing out on the political stage or in the education system, including how it's all covered by the media, is new. And my hope is that if we can put it into context, you'll be better acquainted with the patterns that keep us trapped in this cycle of progress and retrenchment. But before I take you behind the headlines about CRT, and then back in time to where the fight today really began, let's go back to those protests at Harvard in '83, because the parallels between that era and today are uncanny. And it's a good story.
I was there. I was a witness.
Mari Matsuda is another critical race theorist, esteemed legal scholar, and a lifelong friend of mine. You heard her poetry at the start of the episode.
I really wanted to become a law professor. And the way legal education operates, you need that elite stamp on your forehead that says Harvard. So I went there to get it. And I arrive and there's posters all over the school about desegregating Harvard. And I said, okay, there's my people. And that's how I met Kimberly Crenshaw and other people that have been important to me throughout my life.
Desegregating Harvard's faculty was vitally important to us. Me, Mari, George, and a handful of other young scholars, all from different ethnic backgrounds, found each other in pursuit of this desire to have our education at Harvard reflect what we knew to be true about American life. At the time, it was popular to think that the civil rights movement ended racism. Big institutions were proudly calling themselves colorblind, which supposedly meant all were welcome. But we knew that the systems that we were a part of, like the education system and the legal system, still routinely mistreated people of color. And in Harvard's case, it excluded them altogether.
The experience for students of color who were committed to racial justice was extremely frustrating. There were almost no faculty of color, and the curriculum had not much to offer people who were asking the questions we were asking about racism as part of the American legal system.
We all grew up understanding that laws can perpetuate oppression. We were kids in the 60s and 70s, and our parents never minced words about how society viewed us. In fact, they encouraged us to rally against the laws that subjugated our communities. George Bisharat, who you heard earlier, grew up in California. His familial roots are in Palestine. He remembers his mom pulling him out of class one day in high school so she could take him to see David Hilliard, who was giving a speech at Sacramento University.
She said, you know, I think you ought to hear this guy.
From Washington, in color, Face the Nation, a spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with the chief of staff of the Black Panther Party, David Hilliard.
Do you have a timetable?
What are you, revolutions are not blueprinted. What are you talking about?
Well,
what we're trying to do is we're trying to wage a mass educational campaign. And we recognize before any revolution there's got to be education. And we're prepared to struggle 40, 50 years, however long it takes.
I asked him, what is the Black Panther's position on Palestine? He answered with such depth of knowledge and such acuity of analysis, I was blown away. That was my seminal experience with the real meaning of solidarity. And quite honestly, from that day forward, you know, this brother has my back, I'm going to have his.
I came of age in the time of the anti-war protests, protesting the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement. And my parents were active in both of those movements as well as the labor movement. So I grew up on picket lines, going to big demonstrations that were filling the streets of cities with a commitment to social justice and also multiracial organizing, because my parents in the political formations they were in, it was always multiracial. So critical race theory is something that was predestined for me by my genealogy.
Just like Mari and George's families, mine always encouraged me to stand up for my people. And my parents led by example. One of our most famous family stories is one about my mother desegregating her local pool when she was a toddler. As for me, one of the earliest moments I knew I'd work in social justice was when I saw Texas Representative Barbara Jordan, a Black woman, question the Nixon administration during the former president's impeachment hearings.
Today, I am an inquisitor.
She had this big, booming voice, such authority. And she had this passion for defending the Constitution that really spoke to me.
My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. And I am not going to sit here and be an idle spectator to the diminution, the subversion, the destruction of the Constitution.
I even wrote her fan mail. And however strange it may sound for young people to idolize lawyers like they do rock stars, I'm not the only critical race theorist with an experience like this.
There was something called a movement lawyer.
I saw these movement lawyers like Charles Gary here in California, who was a frequent defender of the Panthers and other Black Power leaders.
One of my heroes was Margaret Burnham, who was a young lawyer representing Angela Davis in the Free Angela Davis movement.
To me, it looked like law was a way to have a voice on behalf of social change, racial justice, those kinds of things. So my plan from early on was to go to law school.
It's like, wow, I could do that. And I think this is true for a lot of us.
Despite everything happening in the world around us at the time, in the Legal Academy, it was still unusual for scholars to center their critiques around race or gender, even among academics considered liberal. There was only one professor in the entire faculty at Harvard's law school addressing racism as something the law could perpetuate in his lectures. Derrick Bell. You can think of Derrick Bell as the founding father of critical race theory. He was a renowned scholar and a trailblazer at Harvard. Bell was the first Black tenured professor in the law school's faculty. And for professors, tenure is the dream. It's a guaranteed position with the school that comes with clout, job security, and a dedicated space to develop and disseminate your research. But Bell, like his students, wanted to see more people of color recruited to the upper echelons of the academy, especially Black women. And after years with no progress towards this goal, Bell decided to leave.
I want you to understand that while I have been here for two decades, I have not forgotten that my appointment represented the culmination of years of student struggle. I remember as well that for the first 150 years of its history, the faculty at Harvard Law, the oldest existing, most prestigious, and in the view of many, the best law school in the United States, was all white and all male. That is a horrible history, not remediable by plaintiff pleas of mea culpa, combined with the token appointment of members of the victim class who are least likely to remind the school of its past racist hiring record.
The law school insisted they were doing everything they could to find qualified candidates of color. In their view, the pool was small. In our view, their criteria made it certain that only one demographic of professor was likely to make it to the top. Ones that held clerkships at the Supreme Court, or worked for the Department of Justice. But for decades, the only people who were allowed in those positions were white men. So we argued that in order to break that cycle, we had to start looking for talent using different criteria.
Unfortunately, those minorities most likely to have these skills are often not attractive to those who believe that a law faculty hired using the standards of the 1950s should serve the needs of the 1990s.
Bell moved in and out of Harvard a few times over the decades, but his first departure was in protest of Harvard's archaic hiring practices in 1981. Or, as Mari Matsuda remembers it, Bell
had been forced out by Harvard's recalcitrant stance toward integration.
When Bell left, the law faculty canceled his course, the course a lot of us enrolled at Harvard specifically to take. And Harvard presented us with something that felt like a Band-Aid solution when we protested.
They offered us two lawyers, one who was white, Jack Greenberg, and Julius Chambers.
Jack Greenberg was director of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund after Thurgood Marshall. They paired him with Julius Chambers, who would lead the NAACP after Greenberg.
You know, both civil rights attorneys, both with very distinguished careers, but they were not candidates for a full-time position. It was this three-week course.
A civil rights course that was about how to be a civil rights litigator. And that's a great class that should be offered at Harvard, but it wasn't what we were looking for. We were trying to develop the theory that became critical race theory. That was the mission, a real understanding of how these systems of racism are perpetuated and how we're going to end them. There was no one on the faculty researching or writing in that direction at that time.
We wanted a little more skeptical and critical approach, which involved asking, in what ways does law continue to perpetuate racial injustice, and not just racial injustice, class injustice, and militaristic policies abroad, et cetera, right? We wanted to first ask, in what ways law is part of the problem, not just the solution, but part of the problem. It was that difference that led us to not enroll in that course and to encourage others not to enroll in it.
Not only did we encourage our fellow students to avoid the class, we organized a boycott. On the day the course taught by Greenberg and Chambers began, 50 students stood outside the lecture hall in defiance. An interview with the New York Times on January 6, 1983, described me that day as a student from Canton, Ohio, who felt the real issue at the heart of this boycott had been obscured. And that assessment was fair, because there were accusations that we, the students, were committing reverse racism by demanding tenured professors of color. The accusations came from the dean, and the news media ran with it. Soon, the story wasn't about a powerful institution refusing to diversify its staff. It was about students balking colorblind policies, policies that most of the public saw as the antidote to discrimination. And it made it seem as if we were angry that a white professor was assigned to teach us in place of Derrick Bell. But our upset wasn't a personal vendetta against Greenberg. It was the fact that the faculty refused to make a real effort to recruit and tenure more scholars of color, and that our critical studies course would no longer center race. So we went to the dean. We sat down with him face to face, and we offered him a list of qualified scholars of color to choose from. In that meeting, he asked us point blank, "Wouldn't you rather have an excellent white professor over a mediocre black one?" At this point, there was no talking left to do. The dean clearly didn't understand what we wanted or why. And this experience in our minds was even further confirmation that colorblind policies reproduce the same realities as discriminatory ones, even when the policy is enforced by people who don't consider themselves racist.
This is the core of critical race theory. Good people can be in charge of institutions that are perpetuating racist results. And Harvard was an example of that, and still is.
So we organized an alternative course. Students didn't get credit, but they did get access to incredible scholars from a range of backgrounds whose identity-centered critiques had been relegated to the margins, despite the fact that they were cutting edge.
We knew that there was a lot of hostility around us, but we were strong and we were fearless. We felt good. We were going to take the place over. And we did have our supporters on the faculty. Some of the people who we challenged accepted the challenge. Some of them were frankly invigorated by what we were doing and inspired by what we were doing. And they told us. And that was really cool.
This was an opportunity that the students created, not the faculty, to learn from the most brilliant scholars who were thinking about race and racism in the legal system. So that was a dream come true for me.
We said, look, you tell us there aren't people. That's what they were saying. Sorry, we can't find anybody to hire in Derek Bell's place. Well, you know, guess what? Here are a whole bunch of accomplished scholars of color from different communities. You know, we brought in an Arab American attorney. We brought in somebody from the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund. We brought in Chuck.
Chuck Lawrence, who Mari later married.
We brought in Neil Gotanda. I think we had Denise Carty-Bonilla, the late RIP. So we tried to demonstrate concretely that there were plenty of people around capable of doing this kind of teaching if you just open your minds.
Students loved it. And that alternative course was where the discipline of CRT began picking up speed. When it was all over, I thought, this can't be the end. We have so much more to do.
Kimberly Crenshaw deserves a lot of credit here. She understood that we needed to gather and that we were all moving in the same direction intellectually and that doing it separately was a mistake, that we needed to be in the same room, argue, get the ideas on the table, work them through, and that happens best face-to-face.
That face-to-face meeting happened years later, in the summer of 89. The Harvard protests, at least the ones we organized, were 6 years behind us. But the issues it laid bare were still in the air. So we gathered a selection of folks from our networks, the lawyers we'd met at conferences over the years, ones we might have whispered to in busy hallways or in someone's hotel room after a conference concluded, lawyers who, like us, knew our ideas about race and gender were unwelcome in the mainstream critical legal studies circles.
Really understanding racism as a lived experience, the history of it, the political economy of it, was not in the front of the discussion in a lot of the white-dominated gatherings we were going to, even the ones on the left.
We met in Wisconsin.
It was rural. It was isolated. It was a convent, and there was no air conditioning in the rooms. There was one common room that had air conditioning, which meant you had to leave your room because it was unbearable. It was that wet summer heat. And so we'd gather in this bare commons room. This was not a one-day meeting. It was long. So you cook together. You see who has a sense of humor and who doesn't, who can play the piano. Things like that matter for building a movement. We needed the breathing room to understand what we had in common, both in our life stories and in our work, and how it was different from both mainstream legal thought and critical thought in the law. So that was part of it, you know, just a space to develop the ideas, but also understanding ourselves as a political formation. That we needed to know each other because we were going into battle together.
At some point during our meeting, a photo, one that I now treasure, was taken of the group. We're all smiling in the sun, staggered in rows.
I think it's important to look at how integrated we are. You know, there's Asian representation, Latinx representation, lots of women, and women were an extreme minority in the legal profession, and women of color especially, but they dominate this meeting. And Derek Bell is there, kind of the senior presence in this group. And I'm just thinking what it must have meant to him, who had really been a lone soldier his entire career, to see all these people who value his ideas. There are also people in this picture, like Trina Griot, who are no longer here, who were foundational members of critical race theory. Yeah. So it's a precious photo.
That meeting was the beginning of our lifelong journey to move race from the margins to the centers of critiques about law and policy. It was the first of many CRT summer gatherings over the years. And now we can say that it was the birthplace of America's most misunderstood anti-oppression tool. All these years later, we're still in battle together. But now the entire country is involved. In my view, CRT is being used as a distraction from the things we should really be worried about. But a lot of folks have trouble seeing that. Instead, they're falling for the idea that CRT is some kind of boogeyman, all while old strategies for dividing multiracial communities keep playing out before us. And the same tired rhetoric about white rights and reverse racism justify the status quo. To me, the cycle of racism and then progress and then retrenchment feels like a movie playing on a loop. Since I was young, since my mother was young and her mother, every generation goes through the same maddening cycle. Yet somehow we forget that we've been here before. So when the movie starts over, we're caught off guard. We don't recognize the plot. In this series, I want to help cure some of that amnesia. So we'll talk about all the clues we had that something like the trouble we're in now was bound to happen. Some of those clues are a few years old, and some are a few centuries old. We'll look at crumbling school systems, ambitious politicians, dangerously uncritical media, and talk to people fighting to keep us above water as all those things converge. United States of Amnesia, The Real Histories of Critical Race Theory, is an AAPF production brought to you by the African American Policy Forum. In this episode, you heard from critical race theorists George Basharat.
Things change in courtrooms because they've already changed in the street. And we can never forget that connection between us in the academy and people outside.
And Mari Matsuda.
Some ill-informed individual recently wrote that critical race theory is anti-Asian. So I had to write a little piece recently schooling people in that.
I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw. Nicole Edwards is our senior producer. Associate producers are Sanaa Hashmi, Sam Hoadley-Brill, and Nadia Nube. Story editing by Sarah Ventry. Mixing and sound design by Sean Dunham. This podcast has beautiful graphics and companion materials where you can learn more about what you heard today. They were designed by AAPF's Destiny Sproul with support from Alicia Greck and Ashley Julian. Research by Anaya Francis and Alex Van Bima. Find this show and other AAPF productions on social media with the handle Intersectionality Matters, or go to our website, usofamnesia.org.